in whom mounts the world will have all the lands of the earth to rule, and no need to cross the poison water. He talks of leading his Khalasar east, after Rhaego is born, to plunder the lands around the Jade Sea. The knight looked thoughtful.
The Carl has never seen the Seven Kingdoms, he said. They're nothing to him. If he thinks of them at all, no doubt he thinks of islands, a few small cities clinging to rocks in the manner of Lorath and Lice, surrounded by stormy seas. The riches of the East must seem a far more tempting prospect.
But he must ride west, Danny said, despairing. Please, help me to make him understand. She had never seen the Seven Seas either, no more than Droga. Yet she felt as though she knew them from all the tales her brother had told her. Viserys had promised her 1,000 times that he would take her back one day. But he was dead now, and his promises had died with him.
"The Dothraki do things in their own time, for their own reasons," the knight said. "Have patience, princess. Do not make your brother's mistake. We will go home, I promise you."
Home. The word made her feel sad. Ser Jorah had his bare island, but what was home to her? A few tales, names recited as solemnly as the words of a prayer, the fading memory of a red door. Was Vaes Dothrak to be her home forever? When she looked at the crones of the Dush Kaleen, was she looking at her future? Ser Jorah must have seen the sadness on her face.
"A great caravan arrived during the night, Khaleesi. 400 horses from Pentos by way of Norvas and Cahor, under the command of merchant captain Bayan Vatayus. Illyrio may have sent a letter. Would you care to visit the Western Market?"
Danny stirred. "Yes," she said, "I would like that." The markets came alive when a caravan had come in. You could never tell what treasures the traders might bring this time, and it would be good to hear men speaking Valyrian again, as they did in the free cities. "Iri, have them prepare a litter."
"I shall tell your cars," Ser Jorah said, withdrawing.
If Khal Drogo had been with her, Danny would have ridden her silver. Among the Dothraki, mother stayed on horseback almost up to the moment of birth, and she did not want to seem weak in her husband's eyes, but with a Carl off hunting, it was a pleasure to lie back on soft cushions and be carried across Vaes Dothrak, with red silk curtains to shield her from the sun. Ser Jorah saddled up and rode beside her, with the four young men of her cars and her handmaids. The day was warm and cloudless, the sky a deep blue. When the wind blew, she could smell the rich scents of grass and earth. As her litter passed beneath the stolen monuments, she went from sunlight to shadow and back again. Danny swayed along, studying the faces of dead heroes and forgotten kings. She wondered if the gods of burned cities could still answer prayers. "If I were not the blood of the dragon," she thought wistfully, "this could be my home." She was Khaleesi. She had a strong man and a swift horse, handmaids to serve her, warriors to keep her safe, an honored place in the Dush Kaleen, awaiting her when she grew old, and in her womb grew a son who would one day bestride the world. That should be enough for any woman. But not for the dragon. With Viserys gone, Daenerys was the last, the very last. She was the seed of kings and conquerors, and so, too, the child inside her. She must not forget. The Western Market was a great square of beaten earth, surrounded by warrens of mud-baked brick, animal pens, whitewashed drinking halls. Hummocks rose from the ground, like the backs of great subterranean beasts breaking the surface, yawning black mouths leading down to cool and cavernous storerooms below. The interior of the square was a maze of stalls and crook-backed aisles, shaded by awnings of woven grass. 100 merchants and traders were unloading their goods and setting up in stalls when they arrived. Yet even so, the great market seemed hushed and deserted compared to the teeming bazaars that Danny remembered from Pentos and the other free cities. The caravans made their way to Vase Dothrak from east and west, not so much to sell to the Dothraki as to trade with each other, Ser Jorah had explained. The riders let them come and go unmolested, so long as they observed the peace of the sacred city, did not profane the Mother of Mountains or the womb of the world, and honored the crones of the Doshkaleen with the traditional gifts of salt, silver, and seed. The Dothraki did not truly comprehend this business of buying and selling. Danny liked the strangeness of the Eastern Market, too, with all its queer sights and sounds and smells. She often spent her mornings there, nibbling tree eggs, locust pie, and green noodles, listening to the high, ululating voices of the spell singers, gaping at manticores in silver cages, and immense grey elephants, and the striped black-and-white horses of the Jogus Nye. She enjoyed watching all the people, too. Dark, solemn Ashayi, and tall, pale Kathin, the bright-eyed men of Yiti in monkey-tail hats, warrior maids from Bayashabad, Shamiriana, and Kaya Kaya Naya, with iron rings in their nipples and rubies in their cheeks, even the dour and frightening shadow men who covered their arms and legs and chests with tattoos and hid their faces behind masks. The Eastern Market was a place of wonder and magic for Danny. But the Western Market smelled of home. Aziri and Jiqui helped her from her litter. She sniffed and recognized the sharp odors of garlic and pepper, scents that reminded Danny of days long gone in the alleys of Tyrush and Myrrh, and brought a fun smile to her face. Under that she smelled the heady, sweet perfumes of lice. She saw slaves carrying bolts of intricate Myrrhish lace and fine wools in a dozen rich colors. Caravan guards wandered among the aisles in copper helmets and knee-length tunics of quilted yellow cotton, empty scabbards swinging from their woven leather belts. Behind one stall, an armorer displayed steel breastplates, worked with gold and silver in ornate patterns, and helms hammered in the shapes of fanciful beasts. Next to him was a pretty young woman selling Lannisport goldwork. Rings and brooches and torques and exquisitely wrought medallions suitable for belting. A huge eunuch guarded her stall, mute and hairless, dressed in sweat-stained velvets and scowling at anyone who came close. Across the aisle, a fat cloth trader from Yi Ti was haggling with a Pentoshi over the price of some green dye, the monkey tail of his hat swaying back and forth as he shook his head. "When I was a little girl, I loved to play in the bazaar," Danny told Ser Jorah, as they wandered down the shady aisle between the stalls. "It was so alive there, all the people shouting and laughing, so many wonderful things to look at, though we seldom had enough coin to buy anything. Well, except for a sausage now and again, or honey fingers. Do they have honey fingers in the Seven Kingdoms, the kind they bake in Tyrosh?"
"Cakes, lamb. I could not say, princess," the knight bowed. "If you would pardon me for a time, I will seek out the captain and see if he has letters for us."
"Very well, I'll help you find him."
There's no need to trouble yourself," Ser Jorah glanced away impatiently. "Enjoy the market. I will rejoin you when my business is concluded."
"Curious," Danny thought, as she watched him stride off through the throngs. She didn't see why she should not go with him. Perhaps Ser Jorah meant to find a woman after he had met with a merchant captain. Whores frequently travelled with the caravan, she knew, and some men were queerly shy about their couplings. She gave a shrug. "Come," she told the others. Her handmaids trailed along as Danny resumed her stroll through the market.
"Oh, look!"
she exclaimed to Doria. "Those are the kind of sausages I meant." She pointed to a store where a wizened little woman was grilling meat and onions on a hot firestone. "They make them with lots of garlic and hot peppers." Delighted with her discovery, Danny insisted the others join her for a sausage. Her handmaids woofed theirs down, giggling and grinning, though the men of her cars sniffed at the grilled meat suspiciously. "They taste different than I remember," Danny said after her first few bites.
"In Pentos, I make them with pork," the old lady said. "But all my pigs died in the Dasvarkisi. These are made of horse meat, Kalishi, but I spice them the same."
"Oh," Danny felt disappointed. But Quaro liked his sausage so well, he decided to have another one. And Ricardo had to outdo him and eat three more, belching loudly. Danny giggled. "You have not laughed since your brother, the Car Regat, was crowned by Drogo," said Iri. "It is good to see, Khaleesi." Danny smiled shyly. It was sweet to laugh. She felt half a girl again. They wandered for half the morning. She saw a beautiful feathered cloak from the Summer Isles and took it for a gift. In return, she gave the merchant a silver medallion from her belt. That was how it was done among the Dothraki. A bird seller taught a green and red parrot to say her name, and Danny laughed again, yet still refused to take him. What would she do with a green and red parrot in a Kalasar? She did take a dozen flasks of scented oils, the perfumes of her childhood. She had only to close her eyes and sniff them, and she could see the big house with the red door once more. When Doria looked longingly at a fertility charm, at a magician's booth, Danny took that too and gave it to the handmaiden, thinking that now she should find something for Iri and Jiqui as well. Turning a corner, they came upon a wine merchant, offering thimble-sized cups of his wares to the passers-by.
"Sweet reds," he cried in fluent Dothraki. "I have sweet reds from Lys and Volantis and the Arbor. Whites from Lys, Tyroshi pear brandy, fire wine, pepper wine, the pale green nectars of myrrh, smokeberry browns and Andalis sours. I have them, I have them."
He was a small man, slender and handsome. His flaxen hair curled and perfumed after the fashion of Lys. When Danny paused before his stall, he bowed low.
"A taste for the Khaleesi. I have a sweet red from Dawn, my lady. It sings of plums and cherries and rich dark oak. A cask, a cup, a swallow. One taste, and you will name your child after me."
Danny smiled. "My son has his name. But I will try your summer wine," she said in Valyrian. Valyrian as they spoke it in the Free Cities. The words felt strange on her tongue after so long. "Just a taste, if you'll be so kind." The merchant must have taken her for Dothraki, with her clothes and her oiled hair and sun-bronzed skin. When she spoke, he gaped at her in astonishment.
"My lady, you are Tyroshi? Can it be so?"
"My speech may be Tyroshi, and my garb Dothraki, but I am of Westeros of the Sunset Kingdoms," Danny told him. Doria stepped up beside her. "You have the honor to address Daenerys of the House Targaryen. Daenerys Stormborn, Khaleesi of the Riding Men and Princess of the Seven Kingdoms." The wine merchant dropped to his knees.
"Princess!" he said, bowing his head.
"Rise," Danny commanded him. "I would still like to taste that summer wine you spoke of." The man bounded to his feet.
"That Dornish swill, it is not worthy of a princess. I have a dry red from the arbor, crisp and delectable. Please, let me give you a cask."
Khal Drogo's visits to the Free Cities had given him a taste for good wine, and Danny knew that such a noble vintage would please him. "You honor me, sir," she murmured sweetly.
"The honor is mine."
The merchant rummaged about in the back of his stall and produced a small oaken cask. Burned into the wood was a cluster of grapes. "The red wine sigil," he said, pointing, "for the arbour. There is no finer drink." "Karl Drogo and I will share it together. Ego, take this back to my litter, if you'll be so kind." The wine seller beamed as the Dothraki hefted the cask. She did not realize that Sir Jorah had returned until she heard the knight say, "No!" His voice was strange, brusque. "Ego, put down that cask." Ego looked at Danny. She gave a hesitant nod. "Sir Jorah, is something wrong?"
"I have a thirst. Open it, wine seller."
The merchant frowned. "The wine is for the Khaleesi, not for the likes of you, sir." Sir Jorah moved closer to the stall.
"If you don't open it, I'll crack it open with your head."
He carried no weapons here, in the sacred city, save his hands. Yet his hands were enough, big, hard, dangerous, his knuckles covered with coarse, dark hairs. The wine seller hesitated a moment, then took up his hammer and knocked the plug from the cask.
"Pour,"
Sir Jorah commanded. The four young warriors of Danny's cars arrayed themselves behind him, frowning, watching with their dark, almond-shaped eyes.
"It would be a crime to drink this richer wine without letting it breathe."
The wine seller had not put his hammer down. Jogo reached for the whip, coiled at his belt, but Danny stopped him, with a light touch on the arm. "Do as Sir Jorah says," she said. People were stopping to watch. The man gave her a quick, sullen look.
"As the princess commands."
He had to set aside his hammer to lift the cask. He filled two thimble-sized tasting cups, pouring so deftly he did not spill a drop. Sir Jorah lifted a cup and sniffed at the wine, frowning.
"Sweet, isn't it?" the wine seller said, smiling. "Can you smell the fruit, sir? The perfume of the arbour? Taste it, my lord, and tell me it isn't the finest, richest wine that's ever touched your tongue."
Sir Jorah offered him the cup.
"You taste it first."
"Me?" the man laughed. "I'm not worthy of this vintage, my lord. And it's a poor wine merchant who drinks up his own wares."
His smile was amiable, yet she could see the sheen of sweat on his brow.
"You will drink," Danny said, cold as ice. "Empty the cup, or I will tell them to hold you down while Sir Jorah pours a whole cask down your throat."
The wine seller shrugged, reached for the cup, and grabbed the cask instead, flinging it at her with both hands. Sir Jorah bawled into her, knocking her out of the way. The cask bounced off his shoulder and smashed open on the ground. Danny stumbled and lost her feet.
"No," she screamed, thrusting her hand out to break her fall,
and Daria caught her by the arm and wrenched her backwards, so she landed on her legs and not her belly. The trader vaulted over the stall, darting between Ego and Rakaro. Quaro reached for an arak that was not there, as the blond man slammed him aside. He raced down the aisle. Danny heard the snap of Jogo's whip, saw the leather lick out and coil around the wine seller's leg. The man sprawled face first in the dirt. A dozen caravan guards had come running. With them was the master himself, merchant captain Bayam Vatiris, a diminutive Norvashi, with skin like old leather and a bristling blue mustachio that swept up to his ears. He seemed to know what had happened without a word being spoken.
"Take this one away to await the pleasure of the cow," he commanded, gesturing at the man on the ground.
Two guards hauled the wine seller to his feet.
"His goods I gift to you as well, princess," the merchant captain went on. "Small token of regret that one of mine would do this thing."
Doria and Jiqui helped Danny back to her feet. The poison wine was leaking from the broken cask into the dirt.
"How did you know?" she asked Sir Jorah, trembling. "How?"
"I did not know, Khaleesi. Not until the man refused to drink.
Once I read Magister Illyria's letter, I feared. His dark eyes swept over the faces of the strangers in the market. Come, best not to talk of it here.
Danny was near tears as they carried her back. The taste in her mouth was one she had known before. Fear. For years, she had lived in terror of Viserys, afraid of waking the dragon. This was even worse. It was not just for herself that she feared now, but for her baby. He must have sensed her fright, for he moved restlessly inside her. Danny stroked the swell of her belly gently, wishing she could reach him, touch him, soothe him. "You are the blood of the dragon, little one," she whispered, as her litter swayed along, curtains drawn tight. "You are the blood of the dragon, and the dragon does not fear."
Under the hollow hummock of earth that was her home in Vaes Dothrak, Danny ordered them to leave her, all but Ser Jorah. "Tell me," she commanded, as she lowered herself under her cushions, "was it the usurper?"
"Yes," the knight drew out a folded parchment. "A letter to Viserys from Magister Illyrio. Robert Baratheon offers lands and lordships for your death or your brother's."
"My brother?" Her sob was half a laugh. "He does not know yet, does he? The usurper owes Drogo a lordship." This time, her laugh was half a sob. She hugged herself protectively. "And me, you said? Only me?"
"You and the child," Ser Jorah said, grim. "No, he cannot have my son."
She would not weep, she decided. She would not shiver with fear. "The usurper has woken the dragon now," she told herself, and her eyes went to the dragon's eggs, resting in their nest of dark velvet. The shifting lamplight limned their stony scales, and shimmering motes of jade and scarlet and gold swam in the air around them, like courtiers around a king. Was it madness that seized her then, born of fear? Or some strange wisdom buried in her blood? Danny could not have said. She heard her own voice saying, "Ser Jorah, light the brazier."
"Khaleesi?" The knight looked at her stranger. "It is so hot, are you certain?"
She had never been so certain.
"Yes, I have a chill. Light the brazier."
He bowed.
"As you command."
When the coals were afire, Danny sent Ser Jorah from her. She had to be alone to do what she must do. "This is madness," she told herself, as she lifted the black and scarlet egg from the velvet. "It will only crack and burn, and it's so beautiful. Ser Jorah will call me a fool if I ruin it. And yet... Cradling the egg with both hands, she carried it to the fire and pushed it down amongst the burning coals. The black scales seemed to glow as they drank the heat. Flames licked against the stone with small red tongues. Danny placed the other two eggs beside the black one in the fire. As she stepped back from the brazier, the breath trembled in her throat. She watched until the coals had turned to ashes. Drifting sparks floated up and out of the smoke hole. Heat shimmered in waves around the dragon's eggs. And that was all.
"Your brother Rhaegar was the last dragon," Ser Jorah had said.
Danny gazed at her egg sadly. What had she expected? 1,000 years ago, they had been alive, but now they were only pretty rocks. They could not make a dragon. A dragon was air and fire, living flesh, not dead stone. The brazier was cold again by the time Khal Drogo returned. Koholo was leading a pack horse behind him,
with the carcass of a great white lion slung across its back. Above, the stars were coming out. The Carl laughed as he swung down off his stallion and showed her the scars on his legs where the Racha had raked him through his leggings.
"I shall make you a cloak of its skin, moon of my life," he swore.
When Danny told him what had happened at the market, all laughter stopped, and Carl Drogo grew very quiet.
"This poisoner was the first," Sir Jorah Mormont warned him, "but he will not be the last. Men will risk much for a lordship."
Drogo was silent for a time. Finally he said,
"This seller of poisons ran from the moon of my life. Better he should run after her. So he will. Jorgal, Jorah the Andal, to each of you I say, choose any horse you wish for my herds, and it is yours. Any horse save my red and the silver that was my bride gift to the moon of my life. I make this gift to you for what you did. And to Rhaego, son of Drogo, the stallion who will mount the world, to him I also pledge a gift. To him I will give this iron chair his mother's father sat in. I will give him 7 kingdoms. I, Drogo Carl, will do this thing."
His voice rose, and he lifted his fist to the sky.
"I will take my Khalasar west to where the world ends and ride the wooden horses across the black salt sea as no Carl has done before. I will kill the men in the iron suits and tear down their stone houses. I will rape their women, take their children as slaves, and bring their broken gods back to Vez Dethrak, to bow down beneath the mother of mountains. This I vow, I, Drogo, son of Barbo, this I swear before the mother of mountains, as the stars look down in witness."
His Khalasar left Vez Dothrak 2 days later, striking south and west across the plains. Carl Drogo led them on his great red stallion, with Daenerys beside him on her silver. The wine seller hurried behind them, naked, on foot, chained at throat and wrist. His chains were fastened to the halter of Danny's silver. As she rode, he ran after her, barefoot and stumbling. No harm would come to him, so long as he kept up. Catelyn. It was too far to make out the banners clearly, but even through the drifting fog she could see that they were white, with a dark smudge in the centre that could only be the direwolf of Stark, grey upon its icy field. When she saw it with her own eyes, Catelyn reined up her horse and bowed her head in thanks. The gods were good. She was not too late. "They await our coming, milady," Sir Willis Manderly said, "as my lord father swore they would."
"Let us not keep them waiting any longer, sir."
Sir Brynden Tully put the spurs to his horse and trotted briskly toward the banners. Catelyn rode beside him. Sir Willis and his brother Sir Wendell followed, leading their levies, near 1,500 men, some 20-odd knights and as many squires, 200 mounted lancers, swordsmen and free riders, and the rest foot, armed with spears, pikes and tridents. Lord Wyman had remained behind to see to the defences of White Harbour. A man of near 60 years, he had grown too stout to sit a horse.
"If I had thought to see war again in my lifetime, I should have eaten a few less eels," he'd told Catelyn when he met her ship
slapping his massive belly with both hands. His fingers were fat as sausages.
My boys will see you safe to your son there. Have no fear.
His boys were both older than Catelyn, and she might have wished that they did not take after their father quite so closely. Sir Willis was only a few eels short of not being able to mount his own horse. She pitied the poor animal. Sir Wendell, the younger boy, would have been the fattest man she had ever known, had she only neglected to meet his father and brother. Willis was quiet and formal, Wendell loud and boisterous. Both had ostentatious, walrus moustaches and heads as bare as a baby's bottom. Neither seemed to own a single garment that was not spotted with food stains. Yet she liked them well enough. They had gotten her to rob, as their father had vowed, and nothing else mattered. She was pleased to see that her son had sent eyes out even to the east. The Lannisters would come from the south when they came, but it was good that Rob was being careful. "My son is leading a host to war," she thought, still only half believing it. She was desperately afraid for him, and for Winterfell. Yet she could not deny feeling a certain pride as well. A year ago, he had been a boy. What was he now, she wondered. Outriders spied the Manderley banners, the white merman with trident in hand rising from a blue-green sea, and hailed them warmly. They were led to a spot of high ground, dry enough for a camp. Sir Willis called a halt there and remained behind with his men to see the fires laid and the horses tended, while his brother, Wendell, rode on with Catelyn and her uncle to present their father's respects to their liege lord. The ground under their horses' hooves was soft and wet. It fell away slowly beneath them, as they rode past smoky peat fires, lines of horses, and wagons heavy laden with hard bread and salt beef. On a stony outcrop of land, higher than the surrounding country, they passed a lord's pavilion with walls of heavy sailcloth. Catelyn recognized the banner, the bull moose of the Hornwoods, brown on its dark orange field. Just beyond, through the mists, she glimpsed the walls and towers of Moat Cailin, or what remained of them. Immense blocks of black basalt, each as large as a crofter's cottage, lay scattered and tumbled like a child's wooden blocks, half sunk in the soft, boggy soil. Nothing else remained of a curtain wall that had once stood as high as Winterfell's. The wooden keep was gone entirely, rotted away, 1,000 years past, with not so much as a timber to mark where it had stood. All that was left of the great stronghold of the first men were 3 towers. 3, where there had once been 20, if the tale-tellers could be believed. The gatehouse tower looked sound enough, and even boasted a few feet of standing wall to either side of it. The drunkard's tower, off in the bug where the south and west walls had once met, leaned like a man about to spew a bellyful of wine into the gutter, and the tall, slender children's tower, where legend said the children of the forest had once called upon their nameless gods to send the hammer of the waters, had lost half its crown. It looked as if some great beast had taken a bite out of the crenellations along the tower top and spit the rubble out across the bug. All 3 towers were green with moss. A tree was growing out between the stones on the north side of the gatehouse tower, its gnarled limbs festooned with ropey white blankets of ghost skin.
"Gods have mercy!" Sir Brynden exclaimed when he saw what lay before them. "This is Moat Cailin? It's no more than a..."
"Death trap," Catelyn finished. "I know how it looks, Uncle. I thought the same the first time I saw it. But Ned assured me that this ruin is more formidable than it seems. The three surviving towers command the causeway from all sides, and any enemy must pass between them. The bugs here are impenetrable, full of quicksands and suck holes and teeming with snakes. To assault any of the towers, an army would need to wade through waist-deep black muck, cross a moat full of lizard lions, and scale walls slimy with moss, all the while exposing themselves to fire from archers in the other towers. She gave her uncle a grim smile. And when night falls, there are said to be ghosts, cold, vengeful spirits of the north, who hunger for southern blood. Sir Brendan chuckled.
Remind me not to linger here. Last I looked, I was a southern myself.
Standards had been raised atop all three towers. The Karstark sunburst hung from the drunkard's tower beneath the direwolf. On the children's tower, it was a great John's giant in shattered chains. But on the gatehouse tower, the Stark banner flew alone. That was where Rob had made his seat. Catelyn made for it, with Sir Brendan and Sir Wendell behind her, their horses stepping slowly down the log and plank road that had been laid across the green and black fields of mud. She found her son, surrounded by his father's lord's bannermen, in a draughty hall with a peat fire smoking in a black hearth. He was seated at a massive stone table, a pile of maps and papers in front of him, talking intently with Roose Bolton and the Great John. At first he did not notice her, but his wolf did. The great grey beast was lying near the fire, but when Catelyn entered, he lifted his head and his golden eyes met hers. The lords fell silent, one by one, and Rob looked up at the sudden quiet and saw her.
"Mother!"
he said, his voice thick with emotion. Catelyn wanted to run to him, to kiss his sweet brow, to wrap him in her arms and hold him so tightly that he would never come to harm. But here, in front of his lords, she dare not. He was playing a man's part now, and she would not take that away from him. So she held herself at the far end of the basalt slab they were using for a table. The direwolf got to his feet and padded across the room to where she stood. It seemed bigger than a wolf ought to be. "You've grown a beard," she said to Rob, while Greywind sniffed her hand. He rubbed his stubble jaw, suddenly awkward. "Yes." His chin hairs were redder than the ones on his head. "I like it," Catelyn stroked the wolf's head gently. "It makes you look like my brother Edmure." Greywind nipped at her fingers, playful, and trotted back to his place by the fire. Sir Helmund Tallheart was the first to follow the direwolf across the room to pay his respects, kneeling before her and pressing his brow to her hand. "Lady Catelyn," he said, "you are fair as ever, a welcome sight in troubled times." The Glovers followed, Galbert and Robert, and Great John Umber, and the rest one by one. Theon Greyjoy was the last. "I had not looked to see you here, my lady," he said as he knelt. "I had not thought to be here," Catelyn said, "until I came ashore at White Harbour, and Lord Wyman told me that Rob had called the banners. You know his son, Sir Wendell?" Wendell Manderley stepped forward and bowed as low as his girth would allow. "And my uncle, Sir Brendan Tully, who has left my sister's service for mine." "The Blackfish," Robert said. "Thank you for joining us, sir. We need men of your courage. And you, Sir Wendell. I'm glad to have you here. Is Sir Roderick with you as well, Mother? I've missed him." "Sir Roderick is on his way north from White Harbour. I have named him Castellan and command him to hold Winterfell until our return. Maester Lewin is a wise counsellor, but unskilled in the arts of war." "Have no fear on that count, Lady Stark," the Great John told her in his bass rumble. "Winterfell is safe. We'll shove our swords up Tywin Lannister's bunghole soon enough. Oh, begging your pardons.
and then it's on to the Red Keep to free Ned.
My lady, a question, as it please you.
Roose Bolton, Lord of the Dreadfort, had a small voice, yet when he spoke, larger men quieted to listen. His eyes were curiously pale, almost without colour, and his look disturbing.
It is said that you held Lord Tywin's dwarf son as captive. Have you brought him to us? I vow we should make good use of such a hostage.
I did hold Tyrion Lannister, but no longer, Catelyn was forced to admit. A chorus of consternation greeted the news. I was no more pleased than you, my lords. The guards saw fit to free him, with some help from my fool of a sister. She ought not to have been so open in her contempt, she knew. But her parting from the Eyrie had not been pleasant. She had offered to take Lord Robert with her, to foster him at Winterfell for a few years. The company of other boys would do him good, she had dared to suggest. Lysa's rage had been frightening to behold. "Sister or no," she had replied, "if you try to steal my son, you will leave by the moon door." After that, there was no more to be said. The lords were anxious to question her further, but Catelyn raised a hand. "No doubt we will have time for all this later, but my journey has fatigued me. I will speak with my son alone. I know you will forgive me, my lords." She gave them no choice. Led by the ever-obliging Lord Hornwood, the bannermen bowed and took their leave. "And you, Theon," she added, when Greyjoy lingered. He smiled and left them. There was ale and cheese on the table. Catelyn filled a horn, sat, sipped, and studied her son. He seemed taller than when she'd left, and the wisps of beard did make him look older. Edmure was 16 when he grew his first whiskers. "I will be 16 soon enough," Rob said. "And you are 15 now. 15. And leading a host to battle. Can you understand why I might fear, Rob?" His look grew stubborn. "There was no one else." "No one?" she said. "Pray, who were those men I saw here a moment ago? Roose Bolton, Rickard Carstark, Galbart, and Robert Glover, the Greyjoy, Helmut Tallheart. You might have given the command to any of them. Gods be good, you might even have sent Theon, though he would not be my choice." "They are not Starks," he said. "They are men, Rob, seasoned in battle. You were fighting with wooden swords less than a year past." She saw the anger in his eyes at that, but it was gone as quick as it came, and suddenly he was a boy again. "I know," he said, abashed. Are you sending me back to Winterfell?" Catelyn sighed. "I should. You ought never have left. Yet I dare not now. You have come too far. Some day these lords will look to you as their liege. If I pack you off now, like a child being sent to bed without his supper, they will remember and laugh about it in their cups. The day will come when you need them to respect you, even fear you a little. Laughter is poison to fear. I will not do that to you, much as I might wish to keep you safe." "You have my thanks, mother," he said, his relief obvious beneath the formality. She reached across the table and touched his hair. "You are my firstborn, Rob. I have only to look at you to remember the day you came into the world, red-faced and squalling." He rose, clearly uncomfortable with her touch, and walked to the hearth. Grey Wind rubbed his head against his leg. "You know about father?" "Yes. The reports of Robert's sudden death and Ned's fall had frightened Catelyn more than she could say, but she would not let her son see her fear. Lord Manderley told me when I landed at White Harbour. Have you had any word of your sister's?" "There was a letter," Rob said, scratching his direwolf under the jaw. "One for you as well, but it came to Winterfell with mine. He went to the table, rummaged among some maps and papers, and returned with a crumpled parchment. "This is the one she wrote me. I never thought to bring yours." Something in Rob's tone troubled her. She smoothed out the paper and read. Concern gave way to disbelief, then to anger, and lastly to fear. "This is Cersei's letter, not your sister's," she said when she was done. "The real message is in what Sansa does not say. All this about how kindly and gently the Lannisters are treating her. I know the sound of a threat, even whispered. They have Sansa hostage, and they mean to keep her." "There's no mention of Arya," Rob pointed out, miserable. "No." Catelyn did not want to think what that might mean. Not now, not here. "I had hoped, if you still held the imp, a trade of hostages..." He took Sansa's letter and crumpled it in his fist, and she could tell from the way he did it that it was not the first time. "Is there word from the Eyrie? I wrote to Aunt Lysa asking help. Has she called Lord Aeron's banners, do you know? Will the Knights of the Vale come join us?" "Only one," she said. "The best of them, my uncle. But Brynden Blackfish was a Tully first. My sister is not about to stir beyond her bloody gate." Rob took it hard. "Mother, what are we going to do? I brought this whole army together, 18,000 men, but I'm not certain." He looked to her, his eyes shining. The proud young lord melted away in an instant, and quick as that he was a child again, a 15-year-old boy looking to his mother for answers. It would not do. "What are you so afraid of, Rob?" she asked gently. He turned his head away to hide the first tear. "If we march, even if we win, the Lannisters hold Sansa and father. They'll kill them, won't they? They want us to think so." "You mean they're lying?" "I do not know, Rob. What I do know is that you have no choice. If you go to King's Landing and swear fealty, you will never be allowed to leave. If you turn your tail and retreat to Winterfell, your lords will lose all respect for you. Some may even go over to the Lannisters. Then the Queen, with that much less to fear, can do as she likes with her prisoners. Our best hope, our only true hope, is that you can defeat the foe in the field. If you should chance to take Lord Tywin or the Kingslayer captive, why then a trade might very well be possible. But that is not the heart of it. So long as you have power enough that they must fear you, Ned and your sister should be safe. Cersei is wise enough to know that she may need them to make her peace, should the fighting go against her. What if the fighting doesn't go against her, Rob asked. What if it goes against us? Catelyn took his hand. Rob, I will not soften the truth for you. If you lose, there is no hope for any of us. They say there is naught but stone at the heart of Castle Rock. Remember the fate of Rhaegar's children? She saw the fear in his young eyes then, but there was a strength as well. Then I will not lose, he vowed. Tell me what you know of the fighting in the Riverlands, she said. She had to learn if he was truly ready. Less than a fortnight ago, they fought a battle in the hills below the Golden Tooth, Rob said. Uncle Edmure had sent Lord Vance and Lord Piper to hold the pass, but the Kingslayer descended on them and put them to flight. Lord Vance was slain. The last word we had was that Lord Piper was falling back to join your brother and his other bannermen at River Run, with Jaime Lannister on his heels. That's not the worst of it, though. All the time they were battling in the pass, Lord Tywin was bringing a second Lannister army around from the south. It is said to be even larger than Jaime's host. Father must have known that, because he sent out some men to oppose them, under the king's own banner. He gave the command to some southern lordling, Lord Eric or Derek or something like that. But Sir Raymond Darry rode with him, and the letter said there were other knights as well, and a force of father's own guardsmen. Only it was a trap. Lord Derek had no sooner crossed the Red Fork than the Lannisters fell upon him, the king's banner be damned, and Gregor Clegane took them in the rear as they tried to pull back across the Mummer's Ford. This Lord Derek and a few others may have escaped, no one is certain, but Sir Raymond was killed, and most of our men from Winterfell. Lord Tywin has closed off the King's Road, it said, and now he's marching north towards Harrenhal, burning as he goes. Grim and grimmer, thought Catelyn. It was worse than she had imagined. "You mean to meet him here?" she asked. "If he comes so far, but no one thinks he will," Rob said. "I've sent word to Harlan Reed, father's old friend at Greywater Watch. If the Lannisters come up the neck, the Crannog men will bleed them every step of the way. But Gorbert Glover says Lord Tywin is too smart for that, and Roose Bolton agrees. He'll stay close to the Triton, they believe, taking the castles of the River Lords one by one until River Run stands alone. We need to march south to meet him. The very idea of it chilled Catelyn to the bone. What chance would a 15-year-old boy have against seasoned battle commanders like Jaime and Tywin Lannister? Is that wise? You are strongly placed here. It said that the old kings in the north could stand at Moat Cailin and throw back hosts 10 times the size of their own. Yes, but our food and supplies are running low, and this is not land we can live off easily. We've been waiting for Lord Manderley, but now that his sons have joined us, we need to march. She was hearing the Lord's bannerman speaking with her son's voice, she realized. Over the years, she had hosted many of them at Winterfell, and been welcome with Ned to their own hearths and tables. She knew what sort of men they were, each one. She wondered if Rob did. And yet there was sense in what they said. This host her son had assembled was not a standing army, such as the free cities were accustomed to maintain, not a force of guardsmen paid in coin. Most of them were small folk, crofters, field hands, fishermen, sheep herders, the sons of innkeepers and traders and tanners, leavened with a smattering of sellswords and free riders, hungry for plunder. When their lords called, they came, but not forever. "Marching is all very well," she said to her son, "but where? And to what purpose? What do you mean to do?" Rob hesitated. "The great John thinks we should take the battle to Lord Tywin and surprise him," he said. "But the Glovers and the Carstarks feel we'd be wiser to go round his army and join up with Uncle Sir Edmure against the Kingslayer." He ran his fingers through his shaggy mane of auburn hair, looking unhappy. "Though, by the time we reach River Run, I'm not certain." "Be certain," Catelyn told her son, "or go home and take up that wooden sword again." "You cannot afford to seem indecisive in front of men like Roose Bolton and Rickard Carstark. Make no mistake, Rob. These are your banner men, not your friends. You named yourself Battle Commander. Command." Her son looked at her, startled, as if he could not credit what he was hearing. "As you say, Mother. I'll ask you again. What do you mean to do?" Rob drew a map across the table, a ragged piece of old leather covered with lines of faded paint. One end curled up from being rolled. He weighted it down with his dagger. "Both plans have virtues, but look, if we try to swing around Lord Tywin's host, we take the risk of being caught between him and the Kingslayer, and if we attack him, by all reports, he has more men than I do, and a lot more armored horses. The Great John says that it won't matter if we catch him with his breeches down. But it seems to me that a man who has fought as many battles as Tywin Lannister won't be so easily surprised. Good, she said. She could hear echoes of Ned in his voice, as he sat there, puzzling over the map. Tell me more. I'll leave a small force here to hold Moat Cailin, archers mostly, and march the rest down the causeway, he said. But once we're below the neck, I'll split our host in two. The foot can continue down the King's Road, whilst our horsemen cross the Green Fork at the Twins. He pointed. When Lord Tywin gets word that we've come south, he'll march north to engage our main host, leaving our riders free to hurry down the west bank to River Run. Rob sat back, not quite daring to smile, but pleased with himself and hungry for her praise. Catelyn frowned down at the map. You'd put a river between the two parts of your army? And between Jaime and Lord Tywin, he said eagerly. The smile came at last. There's no crossing on the Green Fork above the Ruby Ford, where Robert won his crown. Not until the Twins all the way up here, and Lord Frey controls that bridge. He's your father's banner man, isn't that so? The late Lord Frey, Catelyn thought. He is, she admitted. But my father has never trusted him, nor should you. I won't, Rob promised. What do you think? She was impressed, despite herself. He looks like a Tully, she thought. Yet he's still his father's son, and Ned taught him well. Which force would you command? The horse, he answered at once. Again, like his father, Ned will always take the more dangerous task himself. And the other? The Great John is always saying that we should smash Lord Tywin. I thought I'd give him the honour. It was his first misstep. But how to make him see it without wounding his fledgling confidence? Your father once told me that the Great John was as fearless as any man he had ever known. Rob grinned. Grey Wind ate two of his fingers, and he laughed about it. So you agree, then? Your father is not fearless, Catelyn pointed out. He is brave, but that is very different. Her son considered that for a moment. The Eastern Host will be all that stands between Lord Tywin and Winterfell, he said thoughtfully. Well, them and whatever few bowmen I leave here at the moat. So I don't want someone fearless, do I? No, you want cold cunning, I should think, not courage. Roose Bolton, Rob said at once. That man scares me. Then let us pray he will scare Tywin Lannister as well. Rob nodded and rolled up the map. I'll give the commands and assemble an escort to take you home to Winterfell. Catelyn had fought to keep herself strong for Ned's sake and for this stubborn, brave son of theirs. She had put despair and fear aside as if they were garments she did not choose to wear. But now she saw that she had done them after all. "I'm not going to Winterfell," she heard herself say, surprised at the sudden rush of tears that blurred her vision. "My father may be dying behind the walls of River Run. My brother is surrounded by foes. I must go to them." Tyrion. Chella, daughter of Cheek, of the Black Ears, had gone ahead to scout, and it was she who brought back word of the army at the crossroads.
"By their fires I called them 20,000 strong," she said. "Their banners are red, with a golden lane."
"Your father?" Bronn asked.
"Or my brother, Jaime," Tyrion said. "We shall know soon enough."
He surveyed his ragged band of brigands. Near 300 Stone Crows, Moon Brothers, Black Ears, and Burn Men, and those just the seed of the army he hoped to grow. Gunthor, son of Gurn, was raising the other clans even now. He wondered what his lord father would make of them, in their skins and bits of stolen steel. If truth be told, he did not know what to make of them himself. Was he their commander, or their captive? Most of the time, it seemed to be a little of both.
"It might be best if I rode down alone," he suggested. "Best for Tyrion, son of Tywin," said Ulf, who spoke for the Moon Brothers.
Shagger glowered, a fearsome sight to see.
"Shagger, son of Dolph, long..."